Hello and welcome to Think Ahead, a London Business School podcast, which offers evidence-based discussions and insights to help you navigate big business issues. I'm Julian Birkinshaw, Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship and Vice Dean at London Business School, as well as the host of our Think Ahead podcast series. Today we have a special edition of the podcast, which will bring together two of our leading faculty to debate and make the case for differing leadership styles in what I'm sure will be a lively and good-humoured exchange of ideas. I'm delighted to welcome Dan Cable and Nero Sivanathan, both professors of organisational behaviour at London Business School. Dan and Nero will explore the advantages and disadvantages of a humble leadership style versus a dominant style of leadership and discuss a number of questions on the topic. Are the two styles mutually exclusive? What should leaders be aware of before adopting a particular stance? Can two leaders in the same organisation lead effectively with two opposing leadership styles? Nero and Dan, welcome to our Think Ahead podcast. I shall hand over to you both for the discussion.
Hi, my name is Dan Cable. I'm a professor here at London Business School, and one of my favorite topics to think about and study is how we get employees more engaged. And with that comes the idea of leadership and how should leaders act and how should they be in order to facilitate that employee engagement. And with me today is Nero Sivanathan, one of my friends and great researchers on some of the same topics and looking at it from different perspectives. Nero, do you want to start off by just telling us a little bit about what you research and what you're fascinated by when it comes to leadership?
Of course. Thanks, Dan. Great to be here on this podcast with you, albeit virtually, despite the fact that we're a couple of doors away. So as Dan mentioned, I'm a professor of organizational behavior here at the London Business School. I've been here now 16 years, and I think broadly, much of what I research and have thought about over the last 16, if not 20 years, has been around how kind of our judgments, decisions, and behavior is sort of shaped and sculpted and molded by sort of the psychological experience of social hierarchies, leadership, power, status. So great to be here talking about leadership with you, Dan.
It's really interesting that theoretically, leaders have these choices to make. And maybe that's one of the things that we'll discuss. Sometimes I wonder how much of a choice it is and how much of it is based on upbringing or personality, these things that are kind of sticky in terms of who we are. But the idea would be that leaders have these choices about how they not only present themselves, but how they ask others to help them, you know, accomplish organizational goals. And one of the things that I've been really impressed by in your research stream, especially lately, is this idea about sort of using status and using hierarchy and how that might depend on like what the world's doing out there, you know, whether or not there's crisis, for example. And I wondered if, you know, one of my favorite papers that you've written looks at how the lay population might actually really like a bit of dominance. You know, that word dominance, it sounds so dominant. and maybe there's a sense in which some people would think, oh, you know, we don't want dominant leaders. We don't want know-it-all leaders. We don't want leaders that kind of micromanage. But do you want to tell listeners a little bit about that research you've done suggesting that maybe in times of crisis, they might prefer that?
Yeah, very happy to. And so perhaps maybe even before I sort of dive into that work, kind of a little bit of sort of background of sort of how I stumbled upon this. So I got into just broadly being interested in hierarchy. I think they're sort of everywhere, and specifically status. So I think, you know, we spend most of our times sort of thinking about agonizing and monitoring status in our social world, right? And rankings are sort of ubiquitous. There's lots of research shows that, you know, we're almost born with a nervous system that agonizes over status. And then, you know, being in a business school, you know how much rankings of business school kind of pervades everything. Every year, the deans of business schools around the world agonize over where their school is going to place on this social hierarchy of rank and status. So that's kind of where initially my broad interest was sort of founded in or originated from. And in the last sort of 10 years or so, triggered by some great grad students, first of which with Hemant Kakar and then Garrett Brady, have been really interested in this idea of dominance and prestige. And I know dominance sounds, as you said, very dominant and perhaps doesn't sound so great. But there is a long academic history, but also some empirical history behind it. So this idea of dominance and prestige in many owes its roots to evolutionary psychology or evolutionary anthropology. And the idea here is that individuals have sort of these dual strategies that they employ as they try to attain, maintain status. One being dominance, the other being prestige. Dominance is perhaps kind of the first and oldest of these two strategies, and it's exemplified by leaders and individuals who use control, force, coercion sometimes as a way to attain status. Prestige, on the other hand, is one where individuals are trying to gain social rank through demonstrating sort of valued abilities and skill set. Oftentimes, you know, academics refer to this as they engage in sort of informational goods, that I have a set of skill set or knowledge that I share with you volitionally and out of my generosity. And through that, I'm able to get the admiration of others, which then allows me to climb the social hierarchy. So that, if you will, is kind of the roots of it. And it was initially proposed by two evolutionary psychologists, Henrik and Gil White. So we've been sort of studying that broadly, Dan, and I think that's what you were alluding to. And in one of the very first studies, we wanted to explore, you know, are there sort of social contexts that might dictate what type of strategies or what type of leaders we might gravitate towards? Because if you, at the face of it, obviously one sounds far better than the other, right? Who wants to be the leader that is dominant and forceful? You want to be the one that everyone sort of gravitates towards because you have competence and skill set that others admire. So one of the premises was that there are certain social contexts where we might actually prefer dominant leaders. And that's when we wanted to look at whether there were macro environments where we might actually prefer dominant leaders. Part of this was triggered by around the time of this research where we saw various authoritarian leaders or forceful leaders coming into power, right? Everything from Modi to Trump, to Farage, to Erdogan, et cetera. We sort of wondered, you know, why is it that all of a sudden these individuals are folks that the mass populace or the population are gravitating towards? And so what we started finding out is that when the economic environment or the social context creates a lot of uncertainty, whether it be economic uncertainty, social uncertainty, people as a way to claim back control gravitate and show a preference for the types of leaders that lead through power and control. So that is, if you will, kind of at the kind of the abstract level for how sort of social context sometimes molds our preferences. Happy to dive into some of the work, but we, you know, we used a very large, for one of the studies, used zip codes across the US state and merged it with some data that measures the economic uncertainty of that zip code. And we were able to pull participants from various parts of the US and show that when there's economic uncertainty, they show a preference for dominant leaders, both at the state level, national level, etc. So that, if you will, is one example of how the outside world oftentimes impacts or shapes our own preferences towards the type of leaders that we gravitate towards.
You know, Nero, as you're talking there, maybe for the first time in a long time, I have rediscovered and rethought about one of the big differences. And maybe listeners would find this really interesting, actually. You know, there's one whole lens at this, which is how does a leader get and keep power? And there's another whole lens, which is how does a leader inspire other people to kind of get the best out of themselves? And they're both forms of leadership in a way, but it might start showing why there are radical differences in assumptions, you know, because even as you were talking about how leaders sort of go about getting and keeping power, I'm thinking about this this approach to leadership called humble leadership, and some people call it servant leadership, but the goal is to give away power and control and to try to put the power and control in the hands of the people that actually do the work and that have the ideas to get things done. And it's just so interesting. It's one of the coolest things about research, I think, because depending on the frame that you bring to it, it answers a different question almost. And so, you know, one of the things I'm standing here, 17 feet away from you right now, I'm thinking about how when people study things like servant leadership and humble leadership, what those leaders are sort of literally doing is thinking differently about themselves. So being less certain and more open to different ideas working and the ideas themselves, they're thinking about different frames as being useful to them, not because it gives them power, because it sort of engages people and makes them want to help. And frankly, even mistakes, you know, a humble leader really willing to admit things they've done wrong in the past, because it normalizes learning. It kind of normalizes the journey that we all have to bump our knees from time to time and make mistakes as we try new things and learn. And I don't know, I'd be really keen. There's lots of evidence on this sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm trying to do some of my own firsthand research the way you are. But a lot of what I know is just based on the literature. Why does this approach seem to work? And I put work in quotes because it kind of depends on what your goal is as a leader. You know, getting more power and sort of being dominant would not be the goal of a humble leader. Getting things done and getting the best out of other people would be the goal of a humble leader. What are some of your thoughts or reactions about that?
Yeah, it's a wonderful comment, Dan. As you were talking, that sort of triggered lots of ideas. So let's try and sort of tackle them one at a time. So as you started this talking about sort of humble leadership, and I do want to get into some of the great research you've been doing. And you know, for the last, I don't know, 10 plus years, you've been really focused on how do you sort of bring out the very best in people, right? Best at within the individual groups, organizations, but of course, it has huge relevance to leadership. But as you were talking about humble leadership and dominant leadership, and of course, I approach it with the lexicon of dominant leadership and prestige leadership, one of the things that triggered in my mind was sort of what is the impact on others? And so if you look at sort of Henry Ford, and he transformed Ford as a company, arguably had a huge imprint in the automotive industry. He was known as an incredibly dominant leader, to the point where whenever there were individuals who disagreed with him, one of his common statements used to be, you know, my name is on the building. And it was his way of showing it's my way. I'm glad that you have thoughts. They don't really matter because it's reflected in the fact that my thoughts matter more because my name is on the building. But of course, had huge impact, right? Had arguably even positive impact with regards to sort of transforming Ford. Then you have the flip side, someone like Warren Buffett, you know, chairman, CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, has without, you know, by anyone's yardstick, has climbed to the highest level of social status within the industry. And he's someone who really cared about sort of actually actively cared about developing sort of reputation for, you know, in a very subtle manner, steering the multiple individuals that made the decision, various decisions towards their investment decisions. So he was known to give lots of autonomy. They allowed, I think he had about 60 plus individuals who collectively made investment decisions. He oftentimes referred to them as coworkers, those he trusts, respects, etc. Both leaders, vastly different approaches. Both could equally make the claim that they were equally successful in directing the group of individuals, the companies, in the direction that they wanted to. And I think that sort of highlights the broader idea around leadership is that there are multiple avenues towards, again, I'm going to use air quotes here, of success. You know, you refer to as humble leadership, servant leadership, and if you go off into the leadership literature, you and I both know there's a terminology for a type of leader kind of to fill every week, right? There's LMX, there's transactional leaders, transformational leaders, and so forth. I do think the literature is getting to the point or has matured where it is no longer one or the other, but what are the circumstances under which one might be relied on, one might be called upon as the strategy to get things done. And even within dominance and prestige, even though it's viewed as dual pathways, they're not necessarily always distinct pathways, in such that there's lots of subcategories within dominance and prestige. I don't have lots of data for this, but would certainly be interested in looking at this along with my grad students, is that one could possibly be both dominant and prestigious, if you will, dependent on the context. There's a larger literature on context-specific leadership. So those were sort of the immediate thoughts. But Dan, I think what I think the listeners would also love to hear is a lot of the work that you've been doing under this larger rubric around bringing the very best person to the job, your very best selves, which of course has implications for how leaders do that, but also perhaps the knock-on impact of who those individuals gravitate towards with regards to the leadership that they find attractive or they find affinity towards.
That's right. Thank you, Nero. I mean, one of the things that I would really like to start with when talking about my research is it seems to depend on how fast the world is changing and how fast companies need to adapt. You know, and it really is the case that if, you know, Henry Ford's a long time ago, but that modern era, quote unquote, that modern era of management where time and motion studies and the leader having the right answer and saying, this is what you have to do and here's the amount of time you have to do it. And if you don't do it that way, as you say, my name's on the building, I'll fire you. I'll take away your raise just like that. That seems to be a situation where leaders can be dominant because they can be confident. And they say, this is the way I'm setting it up. And I don't want your ideas because those are called mistakes. You know, I need you to do it the way that I told you to do it. And so that approach seems not only viable, but it seems efficient, frankly. And I'm thinking now about a world where companies don't have, like, for instance, Ford made the car in one color for 13 years. You know, we don't have 13 years now. We don't have 13 months. You know, if you're in IT, you don't have 13 weeks. And so it's like the leader can't always have the right answer and instead has to rely on people to come up with ideas to help them, almost to have more commitment and less compliance is one way to think about that. And so this approach of trying to, for example, highlight other people's strengths, or this approach of trying to normalize experimenting and learning, even though it sometimes means there's mistakes, it's the root of adapting. And I really feel like this is part of what the difference is here. You know, I like how when we started this conversation, it's not, is there one best way? It's sort of like, well, what's the world doing? And what is the outcome of this leadership that you want to result? So I'm doing this one study now, Nero, and I'll just bring it up as a quick one. We've got two big studies of how do leaders bring people back into the workplace after COVID and work from home. You know, a lot of people out there, including us, you might have 18 months where you just weren't working in the office. And during that time, you kind of figure out new ways to do old things. And you kind of figure out different schedules when you wake up, when you do your work. How do you connect with other people? How do you connect with clients? And different people had really different approaches and they found different ways. And then all of a sudden, you're supposed to come back to the office. And so in a couple of different organizations, we took a look at, well, what does the role of humble leadership look like? Because, you know, a humble leader might be like, do it your way. You've got ideas and just try them out. And it might be like, bring that new identity that you developed over the last 18 months. I want you to bring that into the office. I'm not going to be draconian and top down. You've been doing the work successfully for 18 months. Just try that out. So we got surprised a little bit by some of the results. In two very different studies, we found that leaders that were more humble, that espoused these tenets of humble leadership, as expected, they were more willing and even encouraging of people to bring the learnings, the new things that they found out, that they discovered when they were working from home. They encouraged them to bring that into the office. But opposite to what we expected, they also were more structured in terms of timing. I'd like to say something about the hours that you should be working or what days you should be working. They were more structured in terms of setting up rules. And, you know, that literally was sort of surprising. That's still somewhat surprising for us. But then what we did is we went back and looked at how those leaders were rated in terms of their perceived effectiveness. Like, were they considered better leaders or not by the people they were leading? And we found that, yes, those humble leaders that said, bring your whole selves and everything that you learned over the last 18 months, bring that into the office, those leaders were judged to be more effective leaders, more inspirational leaders, but they didn't like the structure. It's really interesting. When humble leaders chose these more structured approaches, and this, by the way, Nero, goes to your point that it maybe isn't one or the other. Maybe both types of leaders can do both. But here's a situation where the humble leaders were statistically more likely to choose these structured approaches in terms of like the regulations of returning to the office. Those leaders that did that were judged as less inspirational, less good leaders, and the employees were more likely to quit and less likely to perform well. So, you know, it's just really interesting. This is a paper that we're writing up right now. Grace Cormier and I are writing this up. She's a PhD student at Harvard right now. And it's been really interesting. Number one, what's interesting is how the leaders behaved were definitely visible and noticeable to the workers. And the workers' performance and quitting, like whether or not they stuck around, were affected by this. They were certainly correlated by how leaders acted. But the humble leaders didn't always give the amount of freedom that would have served them well. And I find that to be really interesting. I just wanted to put that out there to you and see if, like, you know, if you had any insights about that, or if you thought that was interesting, or if that meshes in with any of the things that you've read about or any research you've done.
Yeah, Dan, that's incredibly both fascinating and interesting. It certainly would not have been my prediction, right? I think my prediction, given the literature, would have aligned with perhaps the one you had going into it. But as you were walking me through that study, it reminded me of sort of an inherent tension here within this literature. And I think to some extent sort of circles back to this idea of dominance versus humble and what is better. And there's always sort of this fight between two strategies. So there's, I think, generally talking about sort of evolution of work, there's a movement towards less hierarchy and more flat structure. And I think, you know, you talk about it. It allows people to bring out the very best in themselves. You bring your full self and so forth. But the tension that I struggle with, and I think it kind of connects to the data that you just presented, but perhaps you might have sort of further insight into this, is we know that sort of hierarchies just form, whether it be baboons, whether it be dogs, school-age children in the cafeteria. Hierarchies just naturally form, right? So it reminds me of Zappos. They sort of wanted this flat organization. I think Deb Grinfeld and Laura Tiedens have a great references. I think Bob Sutton talks about this as well, that they wanted to ensure that everyone had felt that they had no more or less power than each other. I think they called it holacracy or something to that effect. But what becomes very clear is that despite all of these structural attempts at trying to make it flat, invariably there were power hierarchies that occur even within those small groups of individuals. You see that even in naturally creating groups, right? So when we bring in groups into the lab and ask them to form a task, very quickly there's a hierarchy. You figure out who informally is viewed as a leader, who has greater influence over others, and that's within minutes of these small groups forming. And I wonder if part of that is there's this natural drive towards hierarchy, and hierarchy has lots of benefits. It's a coordinating mechanism, right? It allows me to understand who I need to direct my attention towards and coordinate around workplaces. Ironically enough, and maybe this is partly the tension, is while I think Zappos did get rid of sort of titles and try to keep it flat, the CEO still referred to him as the CEO. Right? So despite all of that, it was still very clear, I am the overall boss of this flat organization. Anyhow, it was an interesting irony that I noticed when reading about this. You know, there are lots of tech companies that try to do this, and I wonder if part of that is that this structural attempt, right? In some ways, COVID presented that because people worked from home. There wasn't this constant reminders of titles, meeting up with folks that had greater power, greater access to resources, and then sort of coming back into this formalized workplace, it sort of reminded or reignited this inherent tension that groups invariably find order in hierarchy. Organizations are moving more towards wanting to have less hierarchy, and this tension sort of plays out. And maybe that's where the knock-on effects or the externalities are seen through the leaders that people you would have thought they would like are not rated as favorably, and other leaders that are rated favorably that you would not a priori, I believe, would be the type of leaders one would gravitate towards. Anyhow, I don't know if I've necessarily provided greater clarity to your data, but it certainly triggered this inherent tension that I've always had between sort of where people want to go, and it sounds great, versus what naturally comes to us, as it does to chimpanzees, our closest relatives, with regards to our appeal and our tendency to gravitate towards hierarchies.
I would like to have a little bit of more conversation about the sort of evolutionary lens. And it's not a lens that I know enough about, but I really understand and agree that from packs of wolves to, I don't know, tribes of baboons? How do baboons hang out? I'm not sure what they're called. Clusters of families. But I think that naturally occurring hierarchy is something that's, it's not arguable. Sometimes I really wonder about these organizations that we set up, meaning that if a wolf rises to the top, it might be because they're powerful enough to protect the other wolves if they get in a scrap. But weirdly, if a Henry Ford puts a manager in charge of 400 workers, that manager often isn't really willing to protect those workers from harm or ill will from the outside force. So it's sort of like an assigned or fake hierarchy, but they certainly have a lot of power. They have power over raises and promotions. And a second part of that I think is kind of interesting is there's a lot of research out there, including by our colleague, Ina Inasi, but people like Paul Piff, I think at Berkeley, and just different researchers that have shown that as you get more of this hierarchy type power, it seems to make you have less empathy for the people you lead. Like you kind of see them, the word is instrumentally, like they become a means to your ends. And I think the idea of like more hierarchy often can lead to less trust. And I wondered if we should talk a little bit about those differences. You know, we as management scholars borrow that evolutionary lens, but we as human animals also set up hierarchies for different reasons and perhaps with different results. I didn't know if you ever, I don't know. I have it near. I'm just going to say that out loud. That's not, we are at the edges of my knowledge right now. So I literally don't have like, and here's the great way that I've solved this problem. But I would like to hear if you have given that much thought or anything.
Yeah, I think we could spend a lot of time, you know, as you said, Ina's done some great work in this arena. And you know, I used to dabble quite a bit with power as well. And I used to really like sort of this line that power oftentimes is its own demise. That once you experience or that psychological experience of power, it changes your outlook. It changes the way you view others, you interact with people. You know, there's far less perspective taking. You have a hard time seeing the world and the workplace through the eyes of the very people that you are leading. You show greater overconfidence. And one of the studies that I've always enjoyed was we wanted to look at this idea that powerful individuals just feel like they have greater control, that they're able to take companies in the direction single-handedly, predict the stock market, and therefore be able to adjust strategy. So we brought in a bunch of individuals into the lab, and we asked them to predict the outcome of a six-sided die, right? So a typical die, and says, look, if you could predict what the outcome will be, I think we said you would get an additional payment of $10 or $5 or something to that effect. And this is a old study by Ellen Langer around this idea of illusion of control. But the slightly different tweak here is that in half the group, we sort of primed them with power. We gave them a bunch of tasks that allowed them to feel powerful. The other half did not experience or were not afforded that task. But before rolling the die, we asked them, would you like to roll the die or would you like the experimenter to roll the die? A die roll is a random event, right? You have 1 in 6 shot of rolling it to the number that you think or you've predicted it'll land on. And what you find is that those who sort of experience that momentary sense of power are far more likely to want to roll the die themselves. And to me, it's this nice visceral demonstration of how just power and hierarchies, just while they automatically form, also have a tax on both the leader and, not surprisingly, by definition, the individuals that rely on those leaders. One of the lines that always struck with me, with again going back to sort of Bob Sutton, is, you know, he talks again about sort of hierarchies and how they naturally form. And one of the things that either I read in one of his writings or he's quoting someone else is that perhaps part of organizations isn't to necessarily get rid of hierarchies, but to figure out how do you build the very best hierarchy, or how do you bring out the very best in people given the hierarchy within which you need to operate or people gravitate towards. And I think that in essence is sort of, if you sort of boil down some of the evolutionary elements, it was always around, you know, is this fitness enhancing? And I think hierarchies are fitness enhancing for lots of reasons. And while there is this romanticized feeling of like flattened organizations are good, they do certainly have upside. They also have, as with all things in social sciences, it's messy. There's pros and then there's cons. And, you know, with my grad students, we focused on dominance and, as you said, highlighting all the unintended consequences of dominant leaders. But I think if you were to ask us now, sort of 10 years on doing this and various studies, and also just the literature where it's come in the last 10 years and where it's evolved to, prestige leaders are not necessarily, you know, the very best outcome either, right? So prestige leaders, one of the things is that they want to be liked. They want to be, they want to maintain the respect, the admiration. That comes with some cost as well, because what that means is sometimes you don't want to make difficult decisions. Sometimes you're not decisive. And, you know, not being decisive on a NASA mission has huge consequences. Not being decisive on the battlefield has huge consequences. And so, and this is that sort of, there's both sort of promise, but also perils of the strategies that you employ. And part of it, and part of hopefully what literature and evidence and academia could hopefully provide, is to highlight what are some of the blind spots and some of the bumpers you need to be aware of, dependent on the type of leadership that you might pursue, whether it be a dominant style or a prestige style. They have certain unintended consequences.
That's right. There's some researchers, Bradley Owens and David Heckman, who have done maybe some of the path-breaking work on this humble leadership construct. They've kind of moved it out of the conversations of popular books, Good to Great, for example, and into the scientific literature, you know, with scales that have been validated. And one of their really cool studies is a qualitative study where they tried to look at some of the things that you're talking about right now. For example, under what conditions do followers not really develop more trust in these humble leaders? And some of the very examples you just brought up kind of popped out of that research. You know, when you have to change really quick and you have to make a decision, you might have a voice, but you might not have a vote because there's too many people for me to consult. And I love the idea that you have ideas, but we have to decide this hour. And I think that's a really, really valid and viable, you know, boundary condition or bumper. And I think another one that they talked about is when it's life or death, maybe you want your leader to be more sure, or at least to seem more sure. It doesn't even mean they're always going to be right, but it means they're going to act. And so I don't know how to sort of frame all that in. I don't know how to look at the outcome, but I really hear what you're saying in terms of that almost situational leadership idea of 80% of the time, it might work best to listen to people's new ideas and to ask them to bring the best of themselves to work and to really develop rapport and trust by valuing others, frankly, instead of being dismissive of others. But that doesn't mean that someday or some event won't happen when you'll actually be considered more valuable as a leader by being decisive and moving fast. Nero, as you were talking, one of the last things that I want to make sure that we cover, and it fits in here pretty nicely, it's almost like what emotions do these different leadership styles activate? And if you have a leader that's seen as a good listener and kind and humble and willing to kind of model learning and all this, and then one and the emotional systems that they might be using here, like curiosity, and you're trying to get people kind of enthusiastic, you know, these are the emotions of a humble leader that they activate. But then one day they have to lay down the law and really are firm and clear, and then this is what we're doing, this is why we're moving, they might activate a different circuitry. I mean, all of a sudden, instead of curiosity, that might be anxiety or fear. And that those emotions get stuff done too. And so the complexity here, but also the interest here for me seems to be that the leaders aren't just doing this to serve their own ends, get more power and keep it, but also to help the organization, you know, frankly, win or be effective. I don't know what words we want to use there, but at the right time, still having the ability and the space to use whatever leadership style, almost like a parent. You know what? I don't know if this is right or wrong, but one day your kid runs in front of a car and it doesn't matter how in the house, if you're all kind and listening, you might have to scream at that kid. Because at that moment, fear is the one that's going to work. And I wondered if maybe there's something that we could say about the emotional systems that get activated by these different leadership styles.
It's a great question, Dan. There's lots of stuff around sort of, you know, promotion-seeking systems and prevention-seeking systems in the general motivations through which we approach our lives. As you were wrapping up the last bit, it reminded me of this analogy of sort of wartime leaders and peacetime leaders. And, you know, when I first heard of it, I thought, you have to be kidding. And then there's a rich history and lots of evidence that shows that during wartime, people really want those very decisive individuals. And as you said, they might not necessarily need to be right. In fact, there's lots of historical evidence of leaders who are consistently wrong, but they're still preferred because they are confident, they act and move forward, while others might want to pontificate, ruminate, and that's not the leadership. And it might actually be the right thing to do, but is not what is desired by the populace or the base that is requiring them to display leadership. Emotions are, I think, you know, you and I could spend an entire podcast covering emotions, which I think is one of the most underappreciated forms of communication language that we rely on, not just for leadership, but for coordination I'm not sure if I have the answers to the questions, but it's certainly one of the areas of research that I'm pursuing, is sort of looking at how early childhood environments and sort of your social class, your socioeconomic status has an imprinting impact in how you pursue the avenues through which you garner influence when you're in the workplace. So this idea that there's your early childhood experience of interacting with individuals, the resources that you're exposed to, public school versus private school, museums versus food stamps, all these very difficult elements that shape the pathway. Our belief that is that it does set into motion the type of influence that you pursue, not just when you're in the playground, but when you're in the boardroom. And one of the mechanisms that I think, and your intuition is the right one, is the types of emotions we are trained to utilize and mobilize to enact this influence, whether it be someone who focuses on empathy or someone who focuses on fear versus fright, or various other sort of more forceful emotions versus ones that might help you relate with others. And there's some great work. You mentioned Paul Piff, Michael Krauss, Nicole Stevens have some wonderful work around social class and the impact it has in shaping our emotions and also the emotions through which we interact with others. So it's a very early project, but one that I'm incredibly excited by for the very variables that you highlighted had an intuition play an important role. Of course, this is a fun conversation. I have a feeling we could probably cover two more podcasts around this topic. As a way to sort of wrap this up, Dan, I thought, what is sort of maybe a project you're working on similar to the one I've just highlighted that you're perhaps most excited about that maybe is related to the topic that we covered, but even otherwise a research project that you are really super thrilled and pumped about that you and or your grad students or your co-authors are working on?
Great. Thank you. And I like how you're leading us toward close, because I think we're getting near the top of that hour. But I'll say just a couple of words about a project that it's so interesting that it scares me, Nero. There's a researcher that came up with a set of questions, standardized questions, that bring human beings closer, because as they discuss the questions, they become more intimate and share details that make them more vulnerable. Vulnerability builds trust. Trust builds closer relationships. Now, these have been tested in the psychological realm, but I'm trying to bring these into the realm of organizations and leadership with one of the grad students here, Kendall Smith. What's been so interesting, we now have about 55 dyads, leader-follower pairs, that have gone through this set of questions. They start with questions like, if you had to have dinner with somebody, who would that be and why? Then they get a little more intimate, like, when was the last time that you cried in public? And then they go really intimate. If you lost some member of your family, who would you most hate it to be? It's this sort of like crazy type questioning. I almost can't believe the organization is allowing us to try that. But the initial responses that we're having, and some from the employees themselves, are how hopeful that's been, how interesting that has been. I think some how surprising it's been, because it causes leaders to be human. It causes them to talk about themselves as if they don't have that power. And frankly, I don't know how the data is going to turn out. What we're hoping for is a matched sample of dyads of about 100. And then we think we'll have enough power, statistical power, to actually see, does it increase trust? Because I could imagine some situations where it hurts trust. I could imagine a very dominant leader kind of messing this up in a way. But, that's the beauty of research. And that is, for me, the real proper excitement that I still have around these. That is not a foregone conclusion it'll work, but it's really interesting to see how it works and what it does. And so if we played our cards right, the organization we're looking at named Randstad, they may end up with, on average, greater vulnerability, greater sense of trust, maybe better team relationships and ultimately greater customer satisfaction. But the beauty of research is we don't actually know yet. So I'll end with that, Nero. I find that to be one instantiation of some of these concepts around humility and humanity. And I want to say, too, I've really enjoyed talking with you about these. These topics are really fun. And by kicking it around with somebody else with a different lens, it causes me to see some of the things differently. So thank you.
Likewise, Dan. The project sounds fascinating, and this was a lot of fun. And if I was ever a participant and asked, who would you like to do a podcast with, you would certainly be among the top of that list after this. So this was a lot of fun, Dan, and hopefully the listeners found some value as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nero and Dan, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts and views. You've been listening to Think Ahead, brought to you by the editorial team at Think at London Business School. Follow us here for more episodes or find us on Apple or Spotify. For more faculty research insights and information about our Think Ahead event and podcast series, go to london.edu/think. You can also sign up there for our free regular email newsletter to get updates on our latest publications direct to your inbox.